Thank you. I thought I would put up the logo of the place I presently work, the Oxford Internet Institute, which is a wonderful place. It's allowing me the time and the infinite printout and the support staff for all the things that go wrong. If I worked it, it's quite wonderful. I consider myself to be the only dissenter in the computer field. You don't know how it feels. It's very, very painful, very unpleasant. And when I say the only dissenter, I mean that everyone else is in the same paradigm and they don't know it. I hear people argue about Macintosh versus Windows. To me, they are exactly alike, with little bits of sugar that distinguish them. The fact that the Mac is a better tuned interface is because Steve Jobs is a very good movie director. But that's, we'll get back to it. Macintosh and Windows both use the standard computer interface and conceptual structure designed at Xerox Palo Alto Research Center in the early 1970s. When people talk about the modern GUI, I prefer to call it the PUI, or Park User Interface, because that's what it is. And what does it consist of? Not merely a certain kind of window, but a document structure which mimics paper. The so-called clipboard and the operations of cut and paste. We may get back to the way they changed the meanings of those words in 1984. The notion of applications, the notion of windowing of a certain kind. There was a lot of windowing going on, but the Park windows created a very special formalization. So here are the things I disagree with, and they're all conventions. That's the point. They're conventions. And there's a longer list, but these are just a few I threw together recently. Unexamined computer conventions. The convention of hierarchical directories. You see, today's technical traditions consist of the simulation of hierarchy and the simulation of paper. I'll repeat that. The simulation of hierarchy and the simulation of paper. Now, when newcomers come to the field, we tell them, oh, well, files are hierarchical. I think we call them folders now. Folders, not directories, but folders. And so you put something in a folder, and calling it a folder makes it more friendly sounding. Right? That's exactly the same. And these are hierarchically organized, blah, 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 and that's how it is on the disk. But who put that there? Did God make that disk hierarchical? Hardly. Somewhere around 1945, they said, well, where will we put all these files? And somebody said, well, let's make a file that's a list of file names. And bingo, hierarchical directories were born. Nobody knows when, I'm still trying to find out. But no one has questioned this assumption, lo, these 50 years, 60 years, except me, because I don't think hierarchical anything is suited to most people's lives and thought. Simulation of paper has given us appalling structures for writing, which in no way serve the needs of writing. Well, maybe you're happy with whatever you're happy with, hey. Most people are completely happy with the computer that they've been presented with. So I speak to two groups. My constituency for my new product, one, if there is one, is the kiddie market, the granny market, and the disgruntled market. I don't want to hear from anybody who's happy. So he's like, why do you want to change things? Everything's just fine. I actually, the last time I came to talk, the Wadham College, there was a guy there. Technical fellow, he said, everything's just right. And he could only write the words to that effect. He couldn't think of a thing that was wrong. I can't think of a thing that's right. Because I think it should be completely different. Let's go through these. Hierarchical directories. So I propose crisscross intersecting lists. I'll have a chance. Pick up some standard here. I hope to have a chance to present that. files, big lumps enclosing many parts. Now, what do people really need and what do people really deal with? Items. I take lots of notes. And a magazine article actually criticized me for my ambivalent attitude toward computers because I use paper rather than computers. Ambivalent hell, there is no system in the world on computers that properly takes care of items. What's an item? Name it up. Memorandum. Think what an article, a phrase, connected this point to that point. These are items. I have hundreds of thousands of them on paper. There is no computer system, whatever, that deals with them. There's only paper simulations or spreadsheets, right? Those are the choices? Excuse me. We'll get to whatever. Okay, applications. Now, what is an application? I don't know if applications were invented at Park or whether by Steve Jobs. You know, you all know the classic story. Park, Xerox Palo Alto Research Center was a Xerox at the turn of the 70s was the most successful company in the world. A Niagara of money because they had the only copying machines in the world anybody could use easily. I was always an early adopter. When I was 14, I bought something called the Inventor's Handbook. And it talked about a certain Chester Cronson who invented a process for copying things with static electricity, and then the static electricity caused carbon powder to stick to a drum, matching the image, and then the drum was rolled across the paper and got a copy, and then they predicted you'd be able to make copies in 10 cents. And all of this would be in, was the property of the Haloid Corporation. So I telephoned, I live in Manhattan, I telephoned various places that in the yellow pages said copies, and they said, do you have the new Haloid copier? I said, well, copies cost $1.50. First we have to make an intermediate thing, and it was multi-part thing. They made a negative and made a copy. It was 1953. Well, you see, I've been taken in by Xerox publicity, not for the last time. Because it was another 10 years. Haloid was putting $50,000 into development every year on this project. And it was 10 years later that the Model 914 copier came out and they changed the name to Xerox. So, once that was being too early in the doctor could be very painful. So, anyway, they had a Niagara of money and first, they said, okay, we're going to go head-to-head against IBM, and they bought Scientific Data Systems, which is a manufacturer, very respectable little computer. And they created a new branch, they renamed it Xerox Data Systems, they created a new branch, a division named for every division in IBM. And they said, we're going to compete head-to-head on everything. And of course, this is an incredible catastrophe. They didn't know what they were doing. Then a guy named Bob Taylor, and I don't know who else, they wanted to set up a state-of-the-art thing. So they set up Xerox Palo Alto Research Center at the other end of the country. And they said, well, we want to create, explain computers to the man in the street. And there was a lot of opposition. They were 3,000 miles from Xerox corporate headquarters, 3,000 miles. And they managed to do it, get this thing going. And they had a very, very focused paradigm. Corporate culture. They were going to reproduce paper on screens. And that only became clear eventually. And so they did. And so the two guys who respectively created Adobe and Microsoft Word were both there doing their respective things. And the interface came out of the small talk group and so forth and so on. But they weren't able to productize it. They put out something called the Star at $75,000. And they had carefully researched what secretaries needed. And so the desktop and the clipboard were all designed for secretaries. But nobody wanted to pay $75,000 to support secretaries. And so they called in Steve Jobs. Well, they called in the cavalry. And he walked through and he said, I can sell this thing. And so he built a Lisa and it didn't sell. But he turned around again and built the Mac and that, as you know, took off. And Bamo, the Xerox, and Bill Gates tried to license the Macintosh operating system, and Jobs said, uh-uh. And so Bill said, okay, I'll build my own. And the rest is history, but in any case, the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center, our user interface, or GUI, is now the modern world. And they created the application and every other damn thing. But you see, applications are these wall fortresses of incompatible functionality. So you have to learn all these different functions in order to do things. My view of personal computing has always been, from 1960, that computer should make life simple. It should make it easy to keep track of things. And as far as I know, no one in the world has yet had their lives simplified by a computer. So, now, you could argue that maybe the PDAs are coming close, but again, PDAs have walled applications, too. I'll show you my upside. Paper simulation with only one point of view based on printout. So there's only one way to view paper when simulated on the computer, and it's called WYSIWYG. What you see is what you get. Well, what do you mean when I get? I'm looking at it, you know. But what you get when you print it out. So that's the secret. The word WYSIWYG was a psychological trick to turn the computer into a paper simulator. A paper simulator. Here are the most brilliant minds of the 20th century putting all their efforts into simulating obelisks and paper. And instead, you can be going on to what you really need. A document is a single file. Why? It comes out of the tradition of having, well, you have a text file. Well, we'll add the fonts. Okay, we'll put those in the same file. Well, now we're going to have some links. Oh boy, how many links will link it all point one way because they're all one file? Duh. By the way, never mind. Editing in the paper simulation window, you see. Who do they ask what they should do? At Xerox PARC, they asked secretary. Did they ask writers? Did they ask editors? No. Did they ask movie directors? No. In fact, I don't think they asked anyone who is accustomed to exercising authority because their viewpoint might have been judged as well as it should have been. Because if they'd asked editors and if they'd asked smart, okay, movie directors are typically very smart because they're integrating many, many parts of the story and they have to know all the technicalities that are moving into this. So if you ask a movie director, in fact, I believe that they had gone to Orson Welles and said, Mr. Welles, what should we do with this thing? He would have told them! They didn't want to hear it. But they wanted those people who would support their paper simulation. That's what. And this business about explaining the computer to the man on the street, I figured it out and I checked with Jeff Robeson over there. And Jeff, I said, they weren't trying to explain it to the man on the street earlier. They were trying to explain the computer to Xerox help with management. Yeah. That was the point. Desktop, clipboard, all of these concepts are not incomprehensible to those suits. And so that was what they were doing. As distinct from what humanity really needed. Because my perspective is, I'm not interested in automating trivial crap. Really need to save this goddamn planet, to stay alive as a race, to be able to preserve the ideas of our heritage, move them on. Okay. Disconnected windows. Well, as it happened, someone published an alternative interface for Windows where you got to see the connections between things in one window and things in another window. When was this proposed? I published that picture in 1972. And it has been ignored by acclamation. But that is still, it seems to me, what we need. But you'd have to design your applications very differently, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
You'd have to design your operating system very differently.
Yeah.
They don't want to, because what is an operating system? Well, it's really a file copy program in which to keep adding stuff. How do we get to Windows 90? Windows X, what are we in? XP, MRQ. How do we get it? IBM asked Bill Gates, do you have an operating system we could use for an 8-bit machine based on the ADOA? He said, I think I can come up with one. He sends Kei Nishi down the street and they buy it from two guys who have already built it, called, I think it was Q-Dollars. And they spend $50,000 on this thing. So here they get, $50,000 flat payment. Microsoft proceeds then to sell it for billions and billions of dollars as personal computers are rolled out. Finally, they sold for a couple, they sued and got a couple million. But in any case, then stacking layer on layer, gradually became Windows 3.1, Windows 95, with all the junk underneath, some of which is still there in Windows XP, but it was really this file copy program. So, what does an operating system really want to be? Well, I would say it's something that facilitates all the connections you want to maintain. What don't operating systems have? Undo. Now, I hear there are a few patches that look like that. So. But where do you really need undo? Is it in your document stuff? Not in your backup properly. It's in your operating system because so many things can go wrong. If you are dragging something to a delicate place with the mouse and your finger slips, it can be gone forever. No undo. Why not? Because it's really a glorified file copy program disguised as something important. Relational database. Yes. How do we get relational database? Well, it was actually a guy, a mathematician named Tom, who said that everything should be in rows of equal length for some obscure mathematical reason. Never mind that it means that you can only have a certain number of middle names. Never mind that the tables have to be reconciled by complex means. Anyway, relational database has taken over mainly due to the salesmanship of the Oracle Corporation. But not everything is reachable that's in a relational database. You can make small changes, there have to be huge rebuilds. It's absolutely flipping nuts. And I have some interesting alternatives to show. One way hypertext, excuse me. What is the World Wide Web? Well, it's decorated directories. What Tim did, Tim Berners-Lee, created a file format that pointed at exposed directories on the internet. Well, I've been trying to protect people from hierarchy all these years and say, look, we don't want to have hierarchy visible. No, he makes it visible, and then in the document formats, they're hierarchy internally as well. And anyway, then the real story of the net is that the browser, so-called, was created by a couple of teenagers at the University of Illinois. I guess Eric Neumann wasn't a teenager, but Mark Andreessen was. And they just threw in a salad of all the effects they could, as fast as they could, and bam, we have the web. So I say, let's get away from it, but let's do some better. Embedded markup. Well, that only allows you to reuse things one way. I said they can make markup parallel. Trash can or recycle bin. You have very, very gross levels of undo. You make it much finer. The clipboard. Oh, God, I don't have time to talk about that. Techies in charge of software design and development. Well, would you like to switch? Let me tell a story. When I was about 9 years old, I was raised by my grandparents in New York City on weekends and summers in New Jersey. And my grandfather's a wonderful guy, Norwegian. He loved potatoes. And right after World War II, a number of fascinating new things came up. The supermarket and the deep freeze and the pressure cooker. Okay. And so we had a wonderful pressure cooker, about a foot and a half in diameter, made of heavy cast aluminum. It was about 1946. And it had two knobs. that held the top. And a little flipper with a weight, and you could move the weight, and that determined the pressure. So what you had to do when you wanted to take out goods, was you open the flipper and the steam would go psh, and then you turn the knobs and remove the top. As I say, my grandfather loved potatoes, and this is how he would cook the potatoes. But one night, he was distracted, maybe somebody spoke to him, and he forgot to flip the flipper and to turn the knobs. And there was an explosion, and the top of the pressure cooker hit the ceiling, missing his head, missing smashing his skull by a quarter of an inch. Making a big dent in his head. And he was covered with boiling mashed potatoes. His glasses saved his eyesight. So we drove to the hospital on a Model A Ford. I sat beside him, shaking with pain, but trying not to whimper. All that trip. Cursed and cursed. Goddamn fools who hadn't put an interlock on that to make sure you let off the pressure. I mean, even as a 9-year-old, it was obvious that you could do that. A week later, my great-grandfather, former science teacher, took a strip of steel, a couple of halves of a rubber ball, and put them across between the two handles, and there was no way you could open the thing without letting off the pressure. People who design that pressure cooker are designing software today. My attitude has always been, you cannot trust the techies. So here is my current slogan. Today's computer world is based on techie misunderstandings of human life and human thought. Now, maybe you like it, and hey, I don't want to take away what you like. I'd like you to hear what I would like. And maybe some of you will join. Now, you see, I wasn't technical per se, but I was technically interested. I bought one of the first tape recorders that was made in 1950, I think. I'm a science fiction fan. Photography as a kid, and most of all, I wanted to make movies. My father, later, to my complete surprise, my father was a TV director, and it was only later, after I made my first film, that he abruptly went to Hollywood and started making films. But he never said a word about it, because, of course, it's very sensible from a career point of view not to talk about what you want to do, but just talk about what you want to do. So, what you now call an indie prod, an independent producer, is anybody. I took a filmmaking course once when the guy drilled us. He said, okay, you talk to somebody in Hollywood, he says, what do you do? What is the answer? You say, I'm a producer. Always you say, I'm a producer. But that's respectful, because an independent producer is somebody who puts together a package, one who tries to find the money, get the camera together. Any way you can get that picture taken. Now, I was just shown this morning's news from a visitor is that Sony's new $4,000 camera will do feature films. So it's coming out. That's it. That's an aside. Excuse me. I know this was a clever thing I was going to say. So in college, when I got out of college, I was not, this is background thing, I'm not trying to brag, I just want to give you a sense, because I've done a lot of things, I don't say I did them well, but I had one prize for playwriting and poetry. I had written a book, published a book, produced a long play record. I had small parts on professional stage and television, and I shot a 26-minute film. So I had essentially a media outlook. And an indie prod editor, okay? And what is the editor? You have something you want to build, something you want to create, some media object you want to create. And you find the people who will help you, but basically they're working on your plan. And I thought later, after I discovered the computer, that programmers would be like, cameramen, you know, you'd be able to ask them to do something, and they do it. Well, all I can say now is, if architects, dealing with their technical people, had to grapple with the levels of creative contribution and passive aggressive modification that anyone trying to produce their own software with other programmers faces, there would be no tall buildings. And this is why Jobs is a screamer and Gates is a screamer. And why people were afraid to go into the elevator with Jobs for fear you would fire them. Because only fear is one of the motivations that will keep people doing things the way you want them done. And it's extremely difficult to get programmers to do things the way they want them done because the range of variation and modification open to them is astronomical. If you go to one of my brothers asked me, how come it's so difficult for programmers? I said, well, he's an architect. I said, you know, I just been contractors. He said, no, he said, say no more. But the thing is that a contractor who's fixing your porch cannot simply decide that every Thursday it's going to flip upside down. And a programmer can easily do it. Now, there are people who have taken this model of a producer, director, auteur, trying to create a software package, and succeeded with it. I think Stephen Wolfram in Mathematica, for example. But there are difficulties. For example, I met an ex-employee of Mathematica who said he had decided he should not be working at Mathematica anymore on the day that he threatened Wolfram with a fire axe. So the dynamics of accomplishing things is very different in this world from that of film. Now what I'm doing, some of it is open source, and it's all in the spirit of open source, but it's a completely different notion. I was happy to have Xanadu mentioned, but the point is, I'm avoiding that name now because it's gotten such a bad rap in such some circles. The point of Xanadu was, okay, back up. When I got out of college, I'll tell you what I'd done. A year later in graduate school, I took a computer course. And because of my background in media, I said, holy shit, this is going to be the new home of the human race. Now, at that time, I'd never seen a computer physically, but I understood the price dynamics, and I saw you could put a screen on it. I mean, the air traffic controllers and the guys at NORAD, they had screens. So when prices came down, we'd be working at screens and playing at screens, and that meant that the real issue of the future was the document structure of the future on computers. Others asked later, how can the computer simulate paper? I asked immediately, how can the computer improve on paper? So the issue is, how would we write if we could write in the air? If you could write something over here, something over here, connect it with lines or relationships, and have things pop up and disappear and so on. And what would be the genre of literature we would create around this? And what writing tools would we want? And I've been on that all this time. So Xanadu was and is my continuing project, but right now it's taking an open source version. I just wrote this last night. It's been very hard getting it. This will all be opened up on the first. You can look at it, of course, anytime. There's no picture there. Transliteration. Oops. That does something else on the PC. Yes, I have to do that. Okay. Transliteration. A humanist format for reusable documents. Deep, open, humanist, reuser friendly, non-hierarchical, and indirect. So the idea is that we take apart, to unify today's documents, we need to take apart their idiotic, compressed, hierarchical, encapsulated formats, and put them in a common structure. And that common structure means we are going to look at, we're going to make them into countable elements, put the markup off to the side, and make permanent addresses for every character. Now, when you quote something, you can always go from the quotation to its original context. That was the principal answer I came up with in 1960. How can the computer improve on paper? By making every quotation, keeping every quotation connected to its original context. And that's what I continue to work on, and that is why everything I do is so completely different from what everybody else does, because they don't see the centrality of that issue. So transliterature is breaking existing formats into parallel structures of countable and addressable content and parallel markup and links or clinks, because they do not, they're not one-ended. They go from one place to another, or maybe several others, and you'll be able to follow in any direction at all. The format is extremely simple. The problem is pushed, of course, off into the client. And you'll be able to read more about that soon. I see I'm running low on time, so here we go. I want to get to zigzag, which is much more fun. So this is the document structure. You'll find it at translit.org, and the corresponding copyright method, transliterature. Well, all of us should read, look at after the first audios. So, as far as I'm concerned, while there are many wonderful programming tools, and Photoshop is fantastic. By the way, are you aware that Photoshop was created by two brothers, one of whom is a graphics designer in Hollywood. He did Pirates of the Caribbean, and I don't know what label. So it's an astonishing synergy. So there's nothing wrong with any of that, but the document structures and the ways people are given to keep track of their ideas are pathetic. So I'm working my way toward the new product. Right. The problem is ping-ponging between the two machines. I guess I need to go to the Windows machine. So I invented something in 1983. Incidentally, people refer to me as a computer scientist. For years I've been saying, no, I'm not a computer scientist. I just realized, yeah, I'm a computer scientist. I have a PhD, but that's not the point. The point is that for a long time I've been thinking intelligently about frontier issues. But that's the definition. So, what I invented in 1983, but couldn't actually see until 1997, is a structure which so simplifies data that I propose it as a method that subsumes lists, tables, spreadsheet, relational database, and anything else that's made up of connected cell information, such as Quicken files, and like that. So I'll show it to you now, and it's so simple that most people can't understand it. Again, I'm trying to compress 45 years of work into 45 minutes of talk, so it's a little different. Okay. Now here, let me give the standard one to my family demo. So here is a picture taken in the hot summer of 1991 that shows my grandfather here with the white bow tie. He's 13 years old. And his 10 brothers and sisters and his parents. So, my name is Theodore Holm Nelson, he is Theodore Holm, and he is Karelos Theodore Holm, a country preacher outside Stavanger, Norway. So, we all know what a conventional spread family tree would look like, but I'm going to show you a family tree in ZZ structure. The name of the software is Zigzag, and it actually has a US patent, which is just insufferable. Very good. Okay. I lifted previous condition on the Chromebook. Kill this one and fire up the. Every machine I have is a different delete key in a different place. Here we have a cellular structure where, with two windows, which are just a hack way of looking at it, we have two columns, a column of first names and a column of last names. Let's look at the structure first. I'll make some new sense. But unlike a spreadsheet, we can connect these any which way. So for example, I can connect cell over here to the green cell. I'll just do this. Wait. So what we have is free-form sculptures of spreadsheet-like cells in an n-dimensional space. Like a spreadsheet, each cell can have at most two neighbors, one in the positive direction, one in the negative direction, in as many dimensions as you like. There are no other constraints. So the cells may connect promiscuously and provide confusingly, yet if you adhere to some plan, you get some remarkable benefits, and it is mentalizable. While it is a pseudo-space that corresponds to nothing anybody's ever seen, nonetheless, because it has rows and columns and corners and loops, it has a certain comprehensibility if you don't try to confuse each other. Okay, so let's move down into the area here. So the blue cursor is now on the first names, and you see that they're in alphabetical order. But that's fine, because if I put the blue cursor over into the right-hand column, the last names are also in alphabetic order. See, Cecilia Gleason, Cecilia Gleason. It moves too fast for you to see the animation, unfortunately. This is, but it does animate, that can be adjusted. This is an earlier prototype done by Thomas Lucke in Finland. We're working on a better version now. So let's see what we can do. Both of these views presently are in dimensions 1 and 2, but let's put the cursor on Anton Ohm, one of the brothers, and I'm going to pivot the view vertically to dimension children. So watch the numbers in the upper left-hand corner. It's shown right now vertically dimension 2, but if we go to dimension 3, dimension marriage, dimension children, there we have restricted it to the 11 brothers and sisters. I will now mark them. Teresa, Christian, Karlinger, Lena, Cecilia, Anton, Valdemar, Matilda, Dankert, and so now let's pivot once again, horizontally this time, watch the X dimension to dimension marriage, 2, 3, marriage. And here we see, at the top, my great-grandparents, Gajanus and Cecilia, we see Gerard marrying Fanny, Valdemar marrying Ragnar, and Theodore, my grandfather, married Jean, my grandmother, and they had a daughter, Celeste married Ralph, and they had me. Now you can discern readily that unlike family trees on paper, you don't hit the margin. And women are allowed to have ancestors, which is one way to save on complication. You put the whole human race in here. Now, I didn't put my parents' other marriages in, that would take another dimension, but as you can see, it all very simply extends. The choice of dimensions, etc., is an intricate issue. So you're buying in a new problem when you get into this world, but it has some great benefits. So now, let's go up here to the 11 brothers and sisters. Let's pivot horizontally for the grand finale to dimension dates. And we see on the left when each of the 11 brothers and sisters were born, and on the right the last when they died. But since we have only one data structure, specifically orthogonally connected cells, we can create different views, and the views can be programmed independently of the data structure. So, for example, as we go up and down here, the right-hand list is the order of death, and if we go to this, we see the diminishing. You see it diminish as you go away from the current cell. Okay, now for that, I'm going to ask for a volunteer from the audience for the next demo. So we'll just, this is going to be a very similar one. Come on, somebody. Somebody's done video games. So that if you create some other refreshment algorithm, it may end up doing some other odd thing, and that's all up to you. People ask why I insist on leaving up, on not having typed links and not having one-to-many links, and the answer is you can simulate them, and you can create views that simulate them, and I don't want to complicate the setup. Okay, well, thank you very much. What's your name, son? Says we don't have much more time. I'll show you one more side here. If you can please. Okay. So let's put those two ideas together. Transliterature, which is documents defined as portions brought from all over with markup external. And then zigzagging, for holding all the parameters of a dynamic system. Put them all together and what do you get? It's called a, where is it? It's called floating world. It was called ZX and this is still there. Xanadu.com/zigzagfw99. Google doesn't know about it. It's really amazing. Okay, so the point is to be able to view your documents in all sorts of ways. To be able to see documents like this, fountains and streamers of text. You know the crawl on TV? There's a TV presenter, here's some fast-breaking news underneath. You know the raining text, the rainfall of text in the matrix? All of these should be legitimate document presentational structures for all documents. Okay? So we create an infrastructure of fluid content for. And then now we can marry it. We can have flying islands of text and streamers and moons, etc., etc. galleys with side by side stuff. That's out of Alice in Wonderland, that spirally thing. Well, some of this is old. Okay, well, that's the basic idea. So, floating world, we are building cross-platform. The new ZigZag, I can't say too much about it right now, but we believe it is robust and will be cross-platform. And Floating World is intended to be a cross-platform unit that you can copy from Linux to Macintosh to Windows with no apparent difference and use for your documents and your personal data, essentially the personal computer as we know it, and everything else I leave to them. So, thank you very much. You've been great. I'll take questions if there are any time for it.
We've got time for a couple of questions, so Dr. Cross.
I think that's
what you're doing essentially constrains someone to only view their information through a computer. What happens if someone wants to somehow dump it down to a more traditional form, like paper, or like film, or like whatever, or sound?
You can do anything you like. If you wish to discard the digital level, then you are necessarily reducing what you can see. So, reduce it any way you like, is my answer. But I don't have it, I don't have any fixed format for it the way Adobe Acrobat.
Yes, I'm wondering about sound. We're all moving toward podcasting. Are you going to be taking individual words, phrases, or whatever for subsequent quotation analysis?
Okay, tagging, as it's being done now, is generally embedded, which to me is appalling. I put it on the side, but yes, to give you the tools for so that thousands of people can tag the same thing. And audio, for example, should absolutely be part of this. Fundamental visualization for transliterature is parallel streams. So where you can see text, audio, if there's connected, you can connect audio to text, you can connect text to audio, you can make an audio comment on something, you can make a textual comment on something, make a pictorial comment. remember, videos also are also countable units, and so the same format basically applies. So the idea is to make this the simplest possible representation of everything. There was someone in front of you? Yeah?
How much do you think the limitation of trying to be in thin paper is due to the limitation of two-dimensional output media?
Now we've still got flat screens. Right, well, going beyond flat screens is very difficult, very expensive. So, but with a flat screen, if you've seen any today's three-dimensional video games, you can certainly get a fabulous illusion of 3D with those. And I've just read about the new No Glasses 3D, which I had thought was impossible, and I can see how it is possible. That's been very, very expensive. And so all I can say is, we must divorce the structure of the software and the data from any particular input or output devices. You should have freely whatever screens or controllers you want, but if you require 3D, that's a great limit for everybody else. Yeah?
A lot of us will have read Computer Lib when you did it. And it must be very frustrating to spend so long. But wasn't the point that a lot of what you're suggesting that computer systems won't have enough to keep up with? Because Windows are a lot simpler to do than what we were just seeing the time around that. Didn't we have to wait for the processes to get?
Not at all. What I'm doing is simpler than what they do. So it's really a difficult imagination. Computer Lib was a book I wrote in 74, which apparently influenced a lot of people to do things I really hate. And it was an all too subtle pitch for people to back my software. It did not happen. And contrary to rumor, I have never had any backing. The backing from Autodesk for the Xanadu project in 1987 to 92 was for Roger Gregory's company, which was separate from mine. Yeah.
I know they're not at all the same thing, but how did you feel about things like Microsoft's OLI project? How did you feel about things like Microsoft's OLI project that was...
OLED, yeah.
The embedding of different sort of content and that idea of live content.
Right. OLED is hierarchical.
Yeah.
Say no more. Okay, first of all, the copyright and trademark are a tool that are available to the little guy as well as the big guy. And I have for years used trademark as a way of trying to establish identity for the work, the stuff I work on. And if people say copyright is obsolete because of the work of Richard Stallman, Richard Stallman's GNU license is completely based on copyright. The copyright world today is based upon the stereotype of big lump objects which are either transmitted in toto or not. And so we have a parody fight. Do you remember the in Fantasia, the fight between Tyrannosaurus and Stegosaurus. So that's the current copyright debate. The guys are saying, we'll steal it all. We can't have any. We'll steal it all. Yeah. I'm trying to do something entirely different that can be thought of as a middle way. It's about online quotation. So trans-copyright is a completely different notion. The notion that you have permission to include online content in your document, provided it's brought at the time of download from the original. And what does this achieve? Well, first of all, it allows you to reuse stuff in any quantity, presuming that anyone will use it. Now, right now, nobody is using transcopy, right? Because they haven't been methods. Oh, for Christ's sake, I forgot to show you transliterature, which is our working branch. The transcoder, which is our presently working system and allows you dynamically quote online. It's working for everything with Macintosh. I can see this is a Macintosh house. Andrew in Australia promises me that it'll be working with the Mac maybe this week, let's say. But so the transporter, you send it a list of content, and it goes and gets the pieces and concatenates them into an online document, specifically a web page, because that's the easiest. Now, that means that using the transporter, you can build dynamic documents that are brought from all over using other people's copyrighted material. Now, my position has always been the copyright law will not go away, I will work within it. So how can we make it possible for people to come to reuse content? Answer, trans-copyright permission is that permission which says you may reuse this kind of content provided it's brought at the time of download from my server, and that allows payment. That allows people to charge for it. And the open source people scream, they say, what? You're supporting payment? My answer is, of course. Things will be sold online. Documents are being sold online by thousands of different folks, from the New York Times to Steve Jobs. Now, we can either turn our backs on that or try to make that form of sale as beneficial to everyone as possible. If the form of sale allows minute purchase and minute reuse, or reuse in any quantity online, now I have the benefit of being able to say, look at this great movie clip. Listen to this great snatch of song, and you can say, oh, play me more, show me more, for paid content. That's what I'm trying to create. I'm trying to create a bridge so that the commerce, the commercial system, will interact as freely as will work with everybody else. And people say, well, you know, what about the academic world? Everything is free in the academic world. Excuse me. The top 4,000, I believe, journals are very, very expensive and locked up tight. I have the privilege of Oxford and being able to read any page of them at any time. So I can open my old articles, but I can't send them to you because they're copyrighted by the ACM. I can't say, look at this piece from my old article. So trans-copyright is that permission, and the first tool for using it is the transporter, which will allow you to rebuild stuff. Is that roughly the answer you wanted?
Sure, thanks.
Okay. Hi, when you showed that zigzag demo,
yeah,
it was very much like a bra.
Like a what?
A bra.
A bra?
Bra.
Bra, yeah.
Those edges. I've never seen that kind of interface.
It is a bra, right?
I was wondering if you'd come up with any new programmatic options for it. So you get like short, you get things like finding the shortest route in the world.
Oh sure, yeah.
I wonder what you found. Have you come up with any new ways of traversing it programmatically? What are you doing?
We're not up to that yet. We're building a robust infrastructure. As soon as it exists, then such programs anybody can do. Our business model for Floating World basically is that you'll be able to download Zigzag for free and then pay for extras. It's a fairly reasonable model that everybody likes. And it will be highly programmable, all the interfaces wide open. Yeah?
You mentioned the last question, and then carry on with the model.
A question about, you said about the PDAs for basic world applications. You will see supported back to see on the stuff. Are you going to be developing these type of systems, interfaces into mobile devices, which I think are arguably more interested than the usual laptop, desktop.
It's all a question of money. It's all a question of resources. We're trying to do the central stuff first, and if we make enough money, we can do the other. But the point of the floating world is there won't be any application at all. Simply amplitudes. So that if you have your family tree in there, now you can add your phone book and where your great-grandfather is buried, all within a uniform.